Psychology is focused very much on the individual. And so the unit of analysis changes as you go from field to field. And so in sociology, the unit of analysis is typically the groups or even societies. In communication research, it's often the dyad or some communication pair, the sender and the receiver in some way. But in psychology, we boil it down to the individual.
Welcome to Colonia Podcast, a podcast about the use of scientific discoveries and technology applications. We provide the best information on projects participated by Colonia and many more. My name is Gabriela Bernardi, I'm a science journalist, and in today's episode we talk about mating, statistics, and personality with Peter Carl Johansson, associate professor at University of Padua, Italy. And first of all, nice to meet you.
And you, piacere.
And would you please briefly introduce yourself?
Well, you've already covered the big bits about where I work and what I do there, but I'm a researcher and a social and personality psychologist by training. I was educated in America in places like University of Connecticut and New Mexico State University, and I've worked in several countries like Australia and Poland as well. So I got my PhD in 2009 in the area of mate preferences, so what is it that people want and who they're going to date. But I ventured out into other things like we'll talk about today, like maybe mate choice instead of mate preferences, as well as the dark side of personality.
What are the distinctive traits of a psychological researcher compared to research in other fields?
So lots of people struggle with this one because the sentiment is that psychology can't be a science, that you can't systematically study people, or that they confuse it with therapy, or they even confuse it with physics. Nearly every psychology student will tell you a story about, not physics, sorry, with being psychic. Nearly every psychology student will tell you some story about how someone asked them, oh, you study psychology. Well, can you read my mind now? No, of course not. But the letters are similar in the words, and so people assume. Psychological sciences are like any other sciences. They're an attempt to systematically understand the origin of the human mind, but as well as the products of the human mind. So whether it's the social phenomena like things like racism, or whether it's the conditions that lead to someone having, say, a personality disorder, these are all part of the science of psychology. But in reference to how it's different from other, let's call it human sciences, like say sociology or communication sciences, psychology is focused very much on the individual. And so the unit of analysis changes as you go from field to field. And so in sociology, the unit of analysis is typically the groups or even societies. In communication research, it's often the dyad or some communication pair, the sender and the receiver in some way. But in psychology, we boil it down to the individual. So while we might study social phenomena in people in groups, what we're concerned mostly with is how individuals behave in groups or how groups affect individuals. As any science, it's heavily tied into statistics, but every field has its own, let's call them statistical traditions. And psychology has a recent past of some controversy about whether it's replicable, whether we can rely on these findings. And one of the reasons that things are harder to pin down is because that people are hard to pin down. And so people are probably the most complicated organism that we've ever discovered, of course. And therefore, understanding them is extra, extra hard. And so I had a statistics professor once, and he said that studying people seems just way too hard. It's easier to study things like peas, you know, like the peas that you would eat or something like that. This is much simpler to understand agriculture because the level of variance from peas to peas and what makes them grow and all these things is very minimal. So there's very little tolerance around the pea. But for people, there's a huge degree of variability in our behaviors and our attitudes. What psychology is trying to do is just carve up some of that variability and say, okay, we can predict some degree of human performance, let's say in the case of IQ, personality in the case of what I research, things like psychopathy and narcissism, as well as what I'm also interested in is who do we choose to date? Who do we choose to marry? And even who do we break up with potentially?
Very interesting. So, metro is a level of education income. How are the subject of your latest paper? What are you trying to determine in this study?
I mean, it needs a bit of a background because and back in 2016, this company, this international company contacted me and they said, we'd like to do some research with you. We have, you know, data from all over the world. What can we do together? And so I looked and I looked and I had done some research recently, like several, like in 2019, 2018, about education and intelligence in mate choice, but it was experimental. And so it wasn't really about who you choose as much as it was your mate preferences. But in the case of this online dating data that we were able to get our hands on, it's genuine choice of real people, not people who were taking some survey or we were paying them or coming to a lab as a student. These were people who were out there in the world genuinely trying to find partners and making choices. So people's preferences are often what they wish they could have. But the choice is a little bit different because it's, I chose this person. It's a behavior that we rarely had access to in this area of literature. So one of the things we're trying to do is move our understanding on the fact that the role of income and education, and we're calling this competence, of course, together, that it plays not only in mate choice, but how is that one different around the world? And how do we account for those differences with, say, how countries differ from one another? So for instance, we examine things like rates of gender inequality across countries. We looked at things like unemployment rates, and we looked at something that's called the operational sex ratio, which is the number of men and women in a population that are of mating age. And it's an indicator of competitiveness in the mating market. And so what we're really trying to do is kind of advance the theory around how we understand the role that income and education play, and maybe a little bit self-serving as an educated guy, trying to say, okay, does it do me any good to have my PhD and be successful?
What was the role of statistics in this research?
Yeah, it is centrally important. I mean, we're not doing qualitative analysis. My grandmother, if she watches this, I'm sorry, Grandma, but we have 1.8 million people here. And so the only thing we can do are run statistical analyses. We didn't meet these people. We can't have conversations. So what we're really focusing on here are nomothetic trends, which is the kind of average tendency. So you say, well, my friend doesn't care about someone who how intelligent someone is. Okay, that's part of the normal variability that we expect. But the nomothetic approach tries to say the average tendency, the average man, the average woman, that person, it might even be a statistical contrivance. They might not even exist in reality. But we're trying to understand the average man and woman, right? So there's no actual person that is that. It is the tendencies that men and women have in these cases. So we're interested in how in kind of the correlation between competence, remember that's income and education together, how they correlate with the number of what we call the indicators of interest, which is a composite of the number of on the site, of course. On the winks, you can like click a button and wink at a person. You can give them kind of a, you know, like a thumbs up kind of thing. And you can also just send them the message. And so when you put all those together, you get a metric of how interested people are in you. And we correlated that with this income education composite. Then we wanted to know, what's the difference between men and women here? So we then look at the differences in men and women with further analysis, and then we further go and we look at the country level differences we've already talked about, like operational sex ratio and gender inequality, to make sense of from the 20 something countries, and I can't remember now the number, I think it was like 22, how do these country level factors change or predict the kind of country level effect? And so each country has a degree to which education matters, and that varies from country to country. How can we account for that country level differences?
Interesting. And do you feel that the online dating has changed the mating expectations?
A lot. I mean, it's not a completely novel situation because people bring their native biases to these technologies. And so it's not rewriting the dating scene, but it's a bit like something called supernormal stimuli. And so it gives the appearance that there's tons of available partners that are constantly on your phone, that are constantly available. So why would you ever really give anyone a genuine chance who you meet? Because the minute they say something wrong, right? Well, I've got 10 other people. I mean, if you could survey some of your girlfriends, for example, and just ask them to go on Tinder. And in a day, those women will have so many matches in a day that they'll have to turn off their account because it's just flooded. And this has some other interesting knock-on effects. So when you get this feedback from the world that says, every guy likes me, every single one that I wants me, this creates an inflated sense of mate value. And this leads to women, for example, being hyper demanding. A friend of mine just told me a story about for his first date, she demanded that he pay for her Uber to go to the first, like just to meet him, he had to pay for the Uber to go. And this is just a recipe for disaster, because if we have completely blown out of proportion sense of value on the market, we don't give people very good chances because we're intolerant of their idiosyncrasies. But what it leads to is that in the long run, you end up being single because you keep rejecting people. So we've shown in our other research on deal breakers that the people who think that they have more value have more deal breakers. They reject more people because they think they can afford to do so. Indeed, some analytics from Tinder has shown that men tend to swipe for about 50% of all the profiles that they see. But women only swipe for about 3% of all the profiles they see. Of that 50% that men have swiped for, only about 1.5 swipe for them. And in the case of women, about 1.5 they match with, which means that women are getting a 50% return on the men they swipe for, but men are getting a 10%, is that 5% return, right? Still incredibly different feedback from the world. And so I think it creates this kind of competitiveness in the market, maybe even resentfulness among the men who have been excluded. And so maybe this idea of incels comes from in part because of this kind of inability for these men to compete, because this data analytics also shows in Tinder is that it's only the top percent of attractiveness for men and women that really get 90 something plus percent of all the action. So the most of us, like myself included, we're fighting for breadcrumbs, because if you're not, as a guy, if you're not 6 foot tall and have abs and are holding a puppy dog while you're, you know, climbing a mountain, you're out of the game. So I think it leads to some of these problems. I also think it also leads to potential unique forms of exploitation that were harder to do. So like in this case of my friend having to Uber the woman he's never met before. There's this phenomenon that we call foodie calls, which is the flip side of what's called booty calls, right? So booty calls are about sex, but foodie calls, like it sounds, are about food. And so this is typically a female approach to this Tinder kind of lifestyle, which is, I'm just going to use the guy for food. We go out, he buys dinner, because that's essentially the script that, you know, men buy dinner for women and in hopes of continuing a relationship to get to know a woman. And then, I'm not interested. But in many cases, she already knew she wasn't interested in the first place. She just wanted the food. I'm not saying this didn't exist before these dating apps, but it creates greater potential to exploit other people in both financial, of course, and sexual ways, right? So by sexual exploitation, I don't mean things like rape. I mean, even just things like only wanting sex from someone, right? Lying to someone about your romantic intentions. Or maybe you weren't lying. Maybe you simply met the person, you had sex, and then you changed your mind. You end up having more romantic failures in these scenes because you're introduced to people that you would not normally meet. They're not really in your circle. So the benefit of the apps, because I'm all talking about negative stuff, the benefits is you're now exposed to people who you would never have been exposed to before. This is great. If you are new to a city, great. If you are in a kind of life point where you've passed university And now that's usually where people meet their partners. And then once you get out of university, it's very hard to meet people. So they're good introduction services, but there's no guarantee that the quality of who you're introduced to will be there. And so you often have a lot of bad date experiences, and this pulls you down, drags you down, and it makes you a little bit bitter on both sides, men and women. So I think for all the possibilities of meeting new people, it comes with huge costs that just kind of pile up on your shoulders a little bit.
So very, very interesting. And Professor, why do you think this work matters?
Well, the truth is, I mean, it doesn't. It doesn't really matter, right? It doesn't matter because there's bigger fish to fry, right? I'm not curing cancer here. I'm not treating depression here. What we're really doing is trying to understand a phenomenon that is very important to people, right? Finding relationship partners. This is maybe the most fundamental concern in people's lives. So it's important at a personal level, but in a societal level, you're not really doing anything, any great service for the world, because we're not even helping you find a partner. We're simply describing the reality is that, you know, that that as both men and women get more education and income, they both become more appealing to the opposite sex. And the effect simply is stronger in men than it is for women, for example. So what's really important here is that it is a fairly strong refutation of constructivist / feminist models of mate choice, and a much clearer stamp on evolutionary models of mate choice. So just to make it clear, the feminist models of mate choice, or the constructivist models, would predict that men and women have this kind of crossover interaction, that as women get more competent, more education, fewer men should find them appealing. That's not what we found at all. We found that both sexes benefit from more income and more competence, if you will. It's just that men benefit more from it. Indeed, what we found was even a man with his PhD still gets less interest than a woman with a high school degree. So women are already benefiting in the dating market with, you know, just, and this is not even 18-year-olds we're talking. These are people who from on average about 45 years old. So this is not just teenage college student stuff. This is full on adults who've all had the opportunity to go to university. But the 18-year-old, the woman with just simply a high school degree is more appealing than I would be, right? So we don't know anything about these people's attractiveness. We know very little about them because of the nature of the data that we were able to get. But when all of the things are just allowed to freely vary, it seems that, you know, there's this huge premium in men for being more educated, but it still doesn't surpass the sex difference in romantic interest, that men are just more actively engaged with liking and messaging and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, and during your career, you travel a lot, also a student, changing many different positions and countries in the world. And how this experience influenced your work?
I like to travel very much. I was very fortunate to find a job, for instance, in Sydney. And because it was in Australia, they really have to dump a lot of money on you so you can go to the rest of the world. Australia is very far away. The maps don't make it look anywhere near as far as it is. And that leveraged me up to slowly start to integrate kind of cross-cultural research into my field. And so into my research. And so I slowly started adopting cross-cultural samples. I slowly started adopting colleagues from other countries, because I've always believed that a paper, a research study, is a bit like a child, in that it takes a village to raise it. And the more people you have involved, at least in some aspects of the paper gets better. There's a point when there's too many authors, of course, but you can say stronger things when you have data from around the world. So I wasn't originally interested in cross-cultural psychology. My travels were just like, I want to travel. And I happened to meet people who liked the research that I did, who were very welcoming to me. And I just became, without trying, a kind of cross-cultural psychologist. What it did was it allowed me to really improve my science, but also to be exposed to different ways of thinking about the very same problems. So, for example, I have colleagues in Poland who they study similar things that I study, but they're their angle of studying it comes from a different cultural history than mine does. And so we were able to kind of argue, so to speak, in an intellectual way about, well, what do we think is going on with narcissism? Why do we think that, for example, in some countries, narcissism is higher versus other countries? So I think it's been ultimately quite useful for my career. And I'll continue to do that as much as I can, including hopefully soon some grant money, you know, knock on iron or metal, whatever you say in Italy, a grant that I hope to look at, not cross-cultural, but all the different regions in Italy. So I know that there's major, just even on linguistically, differences in regions of Italy. And so we're hopefully going to get a grant that we can study some interesting phenomena in all the 20 regions, all the 20 states of Italy. And so this is not cross-cultural, but this is within the rainbow that is Italy, so to speak, right? Within the range of Italy.
Interesting. So, Professor, we are at the end of this podcast, but last curiosity. I read for your CV that you won the Ig Nobel Award in 2014. And can you comment about it?
Sure. So for those people who don't know what the Ig Nobel is, it's the serio-comic version of the Nobel Prize. There's a famous British actor, his name is Stephen Fry. He says, if you can't win a Nobel Prize, win an Ig Nobel Prize. And like the word says, Ig Nobel, it's meant to be that your study on its surface, it seems like it's funny. But then when you read it a little more, it actually has some substance that you didn't expect was actually there. So we won this award back for a paper we published in 2013. And indeed, I always tell this story to my students, and I think they cry a little bit. I actually wrote this study at a bar on a Sunday, and we got this award. But it's about what's called the dark triad traits, which is mostly what I study, which is narcissism, psychopathy, and Machiavellianism. And we simply link them to what's called chronotype. And the chronotype, most simply, is, are you a morning person or are you an evening person? When do you like to get up? When do you do your most activities? That kind of. And so what we found was that the dark triad were correlated with a nighttime chronotype. And I reasoned that this was the logical niche that these kind of people should occupy because of their kind of what we call a fast life history strategy. So criminality, casual sex, these kinds of things. And this led with really no pushing on my part. I never did anything else with this idea to what they call the niche specialization hypothesis. And they've several studies in several countries have replicated this effect and extended this effect by people like in Chicago and people in Warsaw, that there is this kind of robust correlation between the dark triad, these dark personality traits, and this tendency to be oriented around a nighttime specialization.
Thank you. Thank you so much to Professor Jonasson for joining us today at this podcast, and thanks our listeners. If you have any questions about today's show, you can get in touch on Kelonia Twitter and feel free to subscribe to kelonia.swiss website and be part of the community. In the meantime, stay tuned for our next interview. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. Ciao.